Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2011. Lecture 7, delivered on February 8, 2011. The title of this lecture is Analysis of Financial Statements.
Today, the Analysis of Financial Statements. This is the first of two lectures dealing with using financial statements in finance. Now remember that the financial statements are prepared according to generally accepted accounting standards consistently applied, which means that we always, always take what we see in the accounting statements with a grain of salt. Because accounting statements, as good as they are, they have deficiencies, especially in terms of cost, because a financial statement will not include opportunity cost. And that means that we are not seeing one of the very important large costs that drives decision making. But there you are. We have what we have. Another problem in financial statements prepared according to accounting standards is that they are historical costs. And therefore, we recognize that what we are seeing is what has already happened. What we care about is what is going to happen. So we have to have some way to, for lack of a better term, project onto the future what we are seeing in a company's historical patterns. Now we can do that, but don't ever do that with stock. A stock price is what it is. The history of the stock price has no indication whatsoever about what the stock is going to do after today. You cannot predict the future of a stock price from the history of the stock price. Markets are way too efficient for you to be able to pull any information out of the past and think that you can use it for prediction. It just doesn't work that way. That's stock prices. Now I'm going to start with a little bit of math for you. A little bit of math, and you probably already know this, but when we look at financial statements, one thing that is important to us is to know what changes have happened, the percentage change that has gone on. And I would anticipate that if you have a calculator, you will do these with me so that you will be able to do this on your own as well. So let me take the revenue of a corporation in 2009 and 2010. And I'm going to take as my example for revenue the revenue from a company you might have heard of before, a company that is called Microsoft. I know it's kind of an unusual one. You probably haven't heard of it. But so for 2009, June 30, the end of the fiscal year, 2009, Microsoft's revenues were 58,437.0. No, they didn't earn $58,437. That's $58 billion. God, I'd love to be that company. But for June 30th, 2010, the total revenues were $62,484.0. Now, let us talk about what the growth rate, the annual growth rate of this company's revenues was. The percent change, I want you, for purposes of this class and any class where I would have you as a student, and most classes where you would use quantitative data, to calculate a percentage change, you take the ending value minus the beginning value, all divided by the beginning value, and then you multiply it by 100 to make it a percentage. Now remember, my classes, I expect that as a percentage, you will express it rounded to 2 decimal places as a percentage. Okay? So now we're going to lock and load on this company. We're going to take the ending value, 2010, $62,484.0, minus the beginning value, $58,437.0. We're going to divide all of that by the beginning value, $58,437.0, and then we're going to multiply the result by 100 to make it a percentage. And if you do that with this company, Microsoft, and I encourage you to do it with me because I very much suck at arithmetic. I can make a mistake as well as anyone. 62,484 minus 58,437 equals, divide that by 58,437, and then multiply it by 100, and I get 6.93%. So from 2009 to 2010, Microsoft's revenues grew by slightly under 7%. Now, I sometimes say, is that good or bad? But I'll tell you the answer. There is no good or bad. You have to look at the historical growth rate of the company in terms of revenues. You have to look at the growth rate of revenues of other companies. And you also have to look down the financial statement to see how that growth rate translated into net income. So in other words, a company's growth of revenues might slow, but its net income might rise if it gets more efficient. Or in some other way, it finds some way to enhance shareholder value. Also, a high rate of growth is not always the greatest thing in the world, just because of the old saying, the light that burns brightest burns the shortest. Sometimes a slow and steady growth rate is a sign of good things. Sometimes a high growth rate is a great thing too. You just can't say, looking at this number, 6.93%, that's great, or that's not so good. You have to look at other things. So, for example, keep that number in mind, and we're going to pull up and go to another thing. Let me look at 2008's revenue. The revenue in 2008 for Microsoft was $60,420. So now we could actually go back and say, all right, well, now we can calculate the 2008 to 2009 growth rate. Let's see what that was. And what I'm doing here is I'm doing this, what seems a little bit random, but I'm showing you how we put together our thinking. We've got a 6.93% growth rate for Microsoft's fiscal years 2010. So now let's go back here and let's look at what it was, what the growth rate was for 2009. Well, if we look back at 2009, we see that in 2009, its revenues were 58,437.0. So now the growth rate through fiscal 2009 would have been the ending value 58,437.0 less 60,420.0 all divided by 60. Is that right? Okay, 420. I've got limited room here to see what the heck I'm doing. So we've got 58,437 less 60,420 equals over 60,420 times 100. Let's try that again. Somehow I didn't do that. 58,437 minus 60,420 equals divided by 60,420 times 100. And we get an interesting thing. Negative 3.28%, a negative growth rate. So now I'm going to write the summary of my results. Revenue growth 2009, fiscal 2009, was negative 3.28%. Revenue growth 2010 was 6.93%. So we get a little bit clearer picture of that 6.93%. Now you can begin to say something about that 6.93%, good or bad relative to 2009. What do you say, good or bad relative to 2009? Yeah. They went from negative to positive. That's reason to have an office party. Booze included. You've pulled out of negative territory. So you see, it's not just one number that really tells us anything in any financial situation. It's contextual. So whenever you see, well, here's a financial ratio, here's a growth rate, you always have to reach out from that and say, what's the context of that financial ratio? What's the context of that growth rate? Here we saw 6.93%, and that just, well, it's a number. But now we see in the context of the year before growth rate of revenues, and suddenly it's interesting. Now let's look at something new. Let's go down to the net income line. I'm going to write 3 years of net income here. This is net. And I'll write 2008's net income for Microsoft, 2009, and then 2010. And if I can get down here on the grinder here, we'll have 17,681 for 2008. We'll have 14,569 for 2009. And then for 2010, we'll have 18,760. Now, one thing I'll caution you here. What I'm doing right now is what would technically be called math nerd pig heaven, simply because we're playing with numbers and we're just taking the raw numbers and we're beginning to make meaning out of the raw numbers. And this isn't hard math at all, but it gives you a chance to start playing with the numbers, which is what I want you to be able to do, is to just be able to toss these numbers around, but not just randomly, know what to do. Okay, he's going after growth rates. Before he does anything with ratio analysis, he's actually just going after plain old growth rates. That's more interesting to me in many contexts than all the ratios are. And when I get to ratios, the ratios aren't going to be as interesting to me as changes in ratios from one year to the next. So let's look at this, and I'll tell you why some of this is interesting. Let's look at the growth rate of net income for 2009. For 2009, it would be the ending 14,569 minus the beginning 17,681, all divided by the 17,681 times 100%. And if you beat that one out of the tree, 14,569 less 17,681 equals divided by 17,681 equals times 100%, we get a negative 17.61% growth rate in net income for 2009. Now let's look at the 2010 growth rate, fiscal 2010. In 2010, it would be the growth rate for 2010 would be 18,760, the ending value, less 14,569, the beginning value, all divided by the beginning value of 14,569 times 100%. And if I do that one, 18,760 less 14,569 equals divided by 14,569 times 100. We get 28.77%. Now we're getting more interesting results. What do you see? What do you see when you look at the growth rates of the revenues against the growth rates of the net incomes? Do you see something, anything at all? Remember what the growth rate of revenue was for 2000. What was the growth rate of revenue for 2009? It was negative 3.28%. And then the growth rate of net income was negative 17.61%. In 2010, the growth rate of revenues was 6.93%, and the growth rate of net income was 28.77%. What do you see? Say it again. In other words, and this is something that we will actually investigate, there's a magnification happening. The financial statement, the income statement, that list of the expenses and interest and all that, is actually like a lens. Every corporation's income statement is a lens. It either magnifies or demagnifies. Usually there's some magnification that happens. And that's something that is of great interest to us. What that magnification is and why it happens. In the next chapter, I think it's the next chapter, you're going to see that there are two sources of magnification. There is magnification that happens because of fixed costs, and then there's a magnification that happens because of your financial leverage. And the reality is that the more your fixed costs dominate your cost structure, the more magnification from the revenue to the net income line there will be. And the more you use debt in your capital structure, the more magnification there will be from the revenue to the net income line. So you see in the case of Microsoft that the net income is very sensitive to what happens at the revenue line. In 2009 with Microsoft, they lost a little under 4% of revenue. A little under 4%. Yeah, that's not horrible. It was a bad year. But look what in the hell that did to their net income line. It blasted that thing down by almost 18%. Do you see why that's important for us when we're looking at financial analysis? Okay, now we can talk about how sensitive net income is to volatility in revenue. Revenue is going to move up and down from year to year. Some years will be great, some years will be meh. But you see, what happens though is what we're interested in is how does that translate into that line where we talk about the residual claim that the shareholders have. You see, that net income line is what the owners care about, the equity holders, because that represents their residual claim on cash flow. At least, well, it's related to it. And so we care very much about that magnification there. And I can't emphasize this enough, and that's why, you know, back in the old days, I would have said, well, here's the calculations for the ratios, and here's the degree of leverage and all this, degree of operating leverage, degree of financial leverage, degree of combined leverage. But really, as time goes on, I've begun to realize you've got to convey this very strongly, that there's this internal dynamic. The decision-making of a corporation determines how strongly the movements of the sales are going to affect the shareholder value. And so when we decide, well, we're going to take on more debt, or we're going to put more fixed assets into the corporation as a percentage of total assets, that has real meaning. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that this is a bad thing. Look how strongly Microsoft recovered in fiscal 2010. Do you see it? I mean, it just came roaring back. And the reason it came roaring back was for the same reason it got its ass kicked in 2009. The magnification factor came around and helped the company out. Now, understand this from an investor's point of view, too. Look around the room here. One thing I always like to do is I've taught long enough that I can see you in 30 years. That's scary enough. Yeah. Oh, God, you're going to be a... no, sorry. You, Dad. you, powerful corporate head, wearing army boots. No, I can do that. But one thing that I can also do, and not as well, though, is see what kind of a risk profile you have. Most people, when they're young, are less risk-averse than you are when you get older. That's the reality of it. But actually, interestingly enough, most young people are pretty much actually fairly conservative. They're not as risk-taking as one might want to imagine. Now, in marketing, we'll play to your imagination that you're all wild and crazy risk-takers. But for the most part, you aren't as risk-taking as you think you are. Most of the risks you take is just because you don't have enough experience. If you knew better, you wouldn't take the risk. There are true risk-takers out there. Have any of you ever had a friend or known someone who was just an absolutely crazy mofo? Yeah. I mean, I bet more than my share of them. We're out running a highway patrolman. Are you nuts? Oh, okay, you've got a Ferrari. We can do it. But here's the reality of it. You see, the amount of risk that a person is willing to take is very much something that investment advisors want to know about. They want the honest answer. But you as an individual, in your life as an investor, and you will be an investor in stocks, bonds, and in yourselves, you are going to want to know how much risk you want to swallow. And so when I look at a company like this, and I look at companies, what I want to know is, are you the kind of person who's willing to take a ride like this? Are you willing to take a bigger ride? Or do you not want to take a ride like this? So for example, suppose that I am advising a 24-year-old. One of you, you've gotten your first big job, you're working at State Barn or something like that, and you're making, let's say, $70,000 a year. Okay? Now, and you've got some money, you've got money that you want to invest. Now, I put you right beside a 65-year-old, and he's got the same amount of money to invest. Let's say it's $100,000. Which one of you would I be more likely to advise to go with something that has a wild ride? The young person, you, or the older person? Which? Yeah, the younger person. You see, that older person, if he loses, he's basically eating dog food in his retirement years, which isn't bad because you can get Alpo at a good price if you buy in bulk. But, I mean, he's going to be bitchy at me and all that. You see, when you're younger, you could take a bigger risk because you have time to recover. Although I wouldn't recommend that you just go hog wild with risk, you would have time to recover. Okay, you want to roll the dice. We're going to talk about prudent, how much of how much you want to put into risky investments. But you see, when I look at what I've just shown you here, this is one of the first things that I would do. I won't look at, you know, these fancy numbers that I'll teach you later, like beta and all that. I'm just going to look at the growth of the company. Is it moving wildly? Is net income moving really hard relative to revenue, or is it moving very gently relative to revenue? That's my first indicator right there about the risk, the volatility of the security. And I know I've got to talk about diversifiable versus non-diversifiable risk and all that, but at the end of the day, this is important. That's why I bitch about this for a while. I just talk about this. It's just check those growth rates from the top line to the bottom line. Check the growth rate. See what's happening. And especially revenue down to the net income. Big stuff. Interesting stuff. And I'm going to show you one other thing here, too. While I'm at this. Let's see if I can find it. Okay. Operating income. I'm going to do the operating incomes here. Okay, that's the one just before interest expense. Okay? Well, actually, I'm going to do a couple here. And I'm just going to write all of these out. Revenue. Excuse me. EBIT. EBT. And net income. I'm going to just try to write all of these out if I can fit them all in this tiny little overhead thing. Transparency thing, if I can here. I already wrote some of these out, but let me try to get them all down here for you in one place. Because the last point of this, okay, 6420 was the first one, 6420 for revenue. Then fiscal 2009, 58437. I had been a little bit more organized, this would have gone faster, 62,484 for 2010. EBIT, is 24071 for 2008, fiscal 2008. $29.76 and then it's like skiing behind a rowboat. $24.690 Okay, now EBT. EBT is 25,268 for fiscal 2008, 20,722. I wish I could project these at the same time, but I can't. The projector goes on, then when I turn it off, it takes forever to power back up. And 25,239. For fiscal 2010, that's EBT. And then those net incomes again, I'm going to have to write down. What were they?
17,681.
17,681 net for 2008. What was it? 14,569 for fiscal 2009. 18,760. 760? Okay. For fiscal 2010. You know what? This thing is smelling so hot. I mean, it's just like, I feel heat. I mean, it's like, I feel like I'm going medium rare. That projector bulb, it's like... No, I'm serious, noobs. It's like, this thing is like... I mean, look, my arm, my hand is... Okay. Anyway... Okay. Now, let me think how I can organize this on this tiny little thing that I've got here. Growth rate. Okay, revenue, and then EBIT. EBT, and then net income for 2009 and 2010. Now, the growth rate of revenue, what was my growth rate of revenue? Negative 3.28, 6.93. Negative 3.28%, and then positive 6.93%. And I got the net income. I already did the net incomes too, didn't I? Negative 17.61%. And then for 2010, 28.77%. Okay, now, let me go through the EBIT. I'm just going to crank them. You crank them, too, and we'll get the numbers out here. For EBIT for 2009, I'd have 29.76. 29.76 minus 24.071 equals... divided by 24.071 times 100, negative 12.86%, negative 12.86% is the growth for 2009 of EBIT. Now, for 2010, the growth of EBIT would be 24,690 minus 29,76 equals divided by 29,76 equals times 100, 17.71%. Now, EBT would be for 2009, 2722 minus 25,268 equals divided by 25,268, and then times that by 100, and we get negative 17.99% is the growth of EBT in 2009. And then for 2010, the growth would be 25,239 minus 27,22 equals divided by 27,22. All right, 27 times 100, 21.80. Now, one thing I'll caution you about, when I do things like this, it's easy to just get these all done and get them on a sheet and just put it up there and say, there's your damn numbers. That it's better to do it when we're all in this together so that you see the machinery of getting it done, instead of just having a PowerPoint put up there with the numbers already prepackaged for you. I want you to talk to me about what we found. And this is all home cooked. Talk to me what we see there. First of all, what was the, you see, when you go from revenue to EBIT, you're seeing the magnification effect of fixed costs. When you go from EBIT to EBT, you're seeing the magnification caused by financial leverage, by your debt. Debt magnifies volatility. Fixed costs magnify volatility. This is where it gets a little bit more difficult. And I was kind of hoping it wouldn't get quite this difficult, but it does. Talk to me. In your judgment, what was the big magnifier? Again, going from revenue to EBIT, the magnifier is fixed costs. Going from EBIT to EBT, the magnifier is your interest, your debt. When you look at this, we see that there was quite a bit of magnification from revenue to net income, right? You see, that was important. Which was the bigger magnifier? You see it? You see fixed cost was actually magnifying, was the strongest part of the magnification here? It wasn't leverage. It wasn't financial leverage. It wasn't their debt that was creating the magnification. It was their fixed costs. Microsoft, it looks from here like Microsoft has a significant fixed cost profile. Now, why should that surprise you? Well, say what? There, yeah. This is a company that's supposed to be, you know, like software. Isn't that something like a couple of geeks sit around a table and they type on computers? But look at the magnification that was created by the fixed costs of Microsoft. They were more than its debt. The fixed costs were more than the debt of the company in terms of magnifying the volatility of revenues over time. This is what we do in finance. And this is why when I teach you finance, especially financial analysis, either as an internal operator in a company or as an outside observer of companies, for a competitor or for an investment house. This is actually the part where we use very hardcore numbers You know, no fantasies, no speculation. But then those numbers allow us to see windows inside of what was happening in the company. Here, I see a company where there is considerable magnification of volatility from revenue to net income. And now I can tell you that that volatility is mostly being caused by the fixed costs of the company. So if Microsoft were to come to me, Bill Gates stops by my house, knocks on the door, "Bill, how are you?" And he says, "Hi, Al." I hate it when he calls me Al. But he said, "Okay, we'd really like to get that volatility magnification down. What would you recommend we do?" I could tell him that. He said, "Well, should we, you know, get rid of some of our debt, make it more equity? Is that what we should do to get this volatility down?" I say, "No, that would not be the first thing that I would do. I would move some of those fixed assets off the table. Get less of your company's total assets in fixed assets. But we have our campus in Redmond." "Oh, there we go. You see that massive fixed cost of the Microsoft empire, its brick and mortar empire? There you go. Stop that. If you want to bring down your volatility profile, the first thing you've got to do is stop putting up so much brick and mortar or something along that line or so much machinery." "Well, how do we get rid of our machinery?" "What would be one way that they could get rid of the machinery?" "Yeah?
Could they sell it?"
"Well, what would they do instead?" "Say it." "Yes." "Well, spank me, Buddha." "Yes." So you can reduce your volatility component created by fixed costs by sloughing off your fixed costs to someplace overseas or to some other company that's willing to have that kind of volatility. This is the beginning of risk management. You see, you are going to have risks in a company. The question is, what is the risk profile that you prefer? Do you want a high risk profile? Do you want a low risk profile? Okay, how do we get your risk profile down? We move risks off you to those who want those risks, who are willing to bear those risks. You do it all the time in your lives. You actually do. Do you drive a car? Oh, okay, that's right, because of that incident with the, you know, running over the nuns. Thank God they all lived. Okay. Well, yes. Hey, he just wanted them to kick the habit. You wait. I got a joke for you. No, wait, I got one. Did you hear about the new Emo brand pizza? Yeah, it cuts itself. Boo. Okay. Rough crowd. Do you have a car?
No.
What the hell? You know? Wait a minute. You do have a car, don't you? I've seen that car. It sucks, but it's a car. No, you have to. Now, you buy insurance for it, right?
Have to.
Well, you have to. Would you buy insurance if you didn't have to?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, you see, you sell risk. You sell risk to companies that are willing to bear that risk. Life insurance is the same way. Health insurance is the same way. We move risk all the time in our personal lives. Companies move risk all the time. I'll show you all kinds of different ways that companies move risk. So if you see a company that is bearing a risk, you have to assume either they want that risk or somehow there's something that's keeping them from getting rid of that risk. But in general, sure, Microsoft could reduce its fixed costs by moving those fixed costs to companies and outsource through those fixed companies, finding companies that are willing to be heavy industrials, the heavies, the big monstrous machinery companies. It can be done. So we get into a whole world of interesting kinds of things that are going on here. Now I'm going to take you down to the next step. And the next time I'll have the financials just straight up for you to see. And we'll just crank them just sort of on the fly. But I want to give you a little bit of terminology here. And some of this I've already said before, but I want to make sure that it sticks in your mind. And this sets us up to do ratio analysis. You know what? I can't even touch this thing now. It's liquidity. Let me ask you this. What is liquidity? Do you remember? No, you were close. Keep going. You're on a roll. That's actually, in practical terms, you're right. How fast you can turn an asset into cash. More generally, ease with which an asset can be turned into another asset. That's technically, but in operation, you're perfectly fine. Think of liquidity as how quickly you can turn an asset into cash. Okay? So some assets, like a big old house, well, it's a great asset, but it has very low liquidity. Are you a liquid or an illiquid asset? Huh? No, you're very illiquid. I can't sell you. I mean, I could, but it's really rough these days, what with the slavery laws. You know? I mean, there's some places in the Middle East that would buy you. But, you know, the thing is, I can't turn you into cash. You can turn into cash. Do you understand that the whole point of what he's doing here is to turn himself into a more liquid asset. Because, in other words, once you have this education, you'll be able to extract cash at a higher rate, a cash flow stream at a higher level, at least at a higher level, maybe even at a higher rate, but certainly at a higher level than you could before you had the education. So there is essentially a liquidification going on with you. Okay, so liquidity, just as a working definition, is how quickly you can turn an asset into cash. Now let's start with some. Cash is as liquid as you get. Treasury bills are as liquid as cash. And then it goes down from there. As far as financial instruments go, high quality debt is liquid. It's not highly liquid, but it's liquid. Now let me ask you this. If I were to say a share of common stock, is that liquid or illiquid? Talk to me. It depends. You say it depends. You got to think like you're over 75. Then you'll say the word depends. Like your life depends upon it. I don't know what the hell that was about, but okay. Yeah, it depends. You see, because in my world, I was a penny stock. I owned a penny stock house. I was open for one day, but, you know, life's a bitch that way. But I had a penny stock house. Now, I had penny stocks. Those were not liquid at all. Once I sold one of those things, that person tried to come back to me and sell it back. I'm sorry. You know, I'll try, but it's going to take me weeks to find a buyer, a match on the other side. But if you've got a share of Microsoft, you can call your broker and you can get your cash within hours. Okay? So securities depend upon the quality. If I've got a debt instrument, an IOU from a very reputable source, I could probably sell that to someone else very quickly and get my money back, and then it'd be his debt to collect. But if I got an IOU from someone, well, if you've got an IOU from me, you're never going to sell that to anyone. You just better hope that I pay off at the end. And so you see, debt, it depends upon the quality, how liquid it is. Okay, so you're going to hear me on Thursday talk about liquidity ratios. Now, liquidity ratios are ratios that tell us how fast a company can get cash if it really needs cash. Okay? And there are different grades of liquidity. Let's try this one. Marketable securities. Lots of liquidity or hardly any, not very liquid. If I said marketable securities, lots. What if I said accounts receivable? Some, it's in the middle. Because there are companies I can sell my accounts receivable to. But I'd probably take a hit. You know, they'd buy them, but at a discount. And a lot of companies in desperate straits will sell their accounts receivable. Let's talk inventory. Highly liquid or very illiquid? Yeah, it's illiquid. It's very hard, once you've got inventory, to find someone. Well, odd lots might buy it. You know, really. I mean, there are companies that actually specialize in that. But boy, you're going to get pennies on the dollar for it. So in terms of, but here's the interesting thing. If you look at a financial statement, the balance sheet, what all of those I just named, cash, marketable securities, accounts receivable, and inventory, what are all of those called on a balance sheet? Assets, but what kind of assets? Current. Short term. In other words, it's not enough for us in finance to say, well, they're current assets. There are actually shades of currency, shades of liquidity within the current assets. So I want to know, how well covered is a company financially if it needs cash? I'd look at all of its current assets. Then I'd say, okay, well, what happens if it's in kind of a hurry to get some money, I'd probably want to take out the inventory. If I said, if they need cash by the end of the day or they are out of business, then I'd want to take out inventory and accounts receivable to see what kind of liquidity we have in the current assets. Okay? So now the next thing that I'm going to do here is working capital. And sometimes you'll hear me say working capital. Sometimes you'll hear me say net working capital. And that's just your current assets minus your current liabilities. Now, ideally, that's going to be a positive number, but it might not be. But we love to think that it is a positive number. In other words, your short-term assets minus your short-term liabilities. If it's positive, you could pay off your current liabilities with your current assets if you were desperate. If it's negative, you couldn't do it. Okay. Now, I'm going to use a few other terms here that I'm just going to introduce today to set it up so that I don't have to try to go through these when we go to the next step. I'm not sure how I should put this one. I've been using this today, and now I'm not going to give you a formal definition of it. I want you to have a definition that's a working definition. Leverage. Leverage is the amount of magnification. Leverage is just the amount of magnification caused by an asset or a liability. So you'll hear me say financial leverage. I'm saying how much magnification of volatility is being created by the debt of the corporation. If I said operating leverage, that would be the amount of magnification of volatility being caused by fixed assets. Risk. Risk is another word for volatility. But it's a special volatility. And I've already brought this one up, and now I want to make sure that we've got it solidly. There are two kinds of risk. There is systematic risk, and there is non-systematic. Systematic risk is otherwise known as non-diversifiable risk. Non-systematic is known as diversifiable. Oops. You are rewarded only for systematic risk. The risk that is in the system, that is part of the system. The risk that you can't get rid of by diversifying. Non-systematic risk is the risk that is not part of the system. The risk, okay. Did you, who's seen the movie Aliens? Yeah, have you ever seen the movie Aliens? Yeah, yeah. Now that is... Oh, sorry. Look. Okay, now, you remember in the movie those things would come out of people? They were inside of you. Okay, now. I'd sense that one's in there. Let me take care of that right now. Do you want me to take care of that with my nice big machine gun? You would really not want me to. Okay, now, suppose that there's an alien that's beginning to massage your scalp. It feels good. You my girlfriend. Okay, now, you would be okay with me shooting that thing, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Oh, okay, I'm a good shot, really. It was an accident the one time, but, you know. Yes. Okay, but now, this is the most the last point. You see, I can shoot the thing when it's not part of your system, and it doesn't hurt you. So if you say, no, no, don't shoot me, you deserve to die. See, that's why we don't reward for the diversifiable risk, for the non-systematic risk, because you can get rid of it. If you don't, that's a personal thing. And now, for the final one. Darth Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi are about to have their last epic lightsaber battle. Darth Vader yells, Obi-Wan, you are toast! And Obi-Wan yells back, ah, yes, but you are on the, your toast is on the dark side. Fine, the hell with you. In this course, profit will mean net income. Now, I will tend to avoid the word profit. Profit is a dirty word. So we say net income. Now, the next one that I'm going to bring up is, in general, in this course, and in general in terminology, the word earnings. Earnings means that you take away the dividends. Now, others will use the terminology differently, but when you hear me use the word earnings, that tends to mean that I've hacked off the dividends before I do anything, okay? Now, just a few other random ones just to set this up. I wrote one down that was really important, and I can't remember what... Oh, right. Book value, book. Sometimes you'll hear me use the word book. That is the value per share from the balance sheet. So if I said book value per share or book, you'll hear me say book value, book. That's usually per share. That is total shareholders, stockholders' equity divided by the number of shares outstanding. In other words, it's a theoretical, not, I don't want you. It's a representation of what the company's, what a shareholder's claim is per share based on the accounting statements. The problem is that it has really, in real life, no meaning whatsoever. But it's always talked about. You see, because what's happening there on that, on the equity, on the shareholders' equity, you're seeing all this stuff like retained earnings. What does that mean? I mean, there's no money. Retained earnings is just a representation of the accumulation of net incomes minus dividends over time. There's no account called retained earnings. So this book value, you'll hear these investment analysts talk about, well, the book value of the corporation is, really doesn't have a whole lot of meaning. But I bring it up anyway because we do talk book value, and I show you how to do the books. But also, there's another important thing in here, too. See that word outstanding? There's another term, fully diluted. Fully diluted means that you take the shares that are actually outstanding, and then you also include the shares that could become outstanding through options and warrants and things like that. Especially those happen with executives. Bill Gates comes to you and says, we want you as a senior level executive. I know you're in Professor C's class, but you've just got to let go of that. We'll give you 5 million shares as an option if you'll join, and you can exercise it in 5 years if you'll join our company now. You see, if I look at just the outstanding shares of the corporation, that will not include those 5 million shares and all the other options, executives' options, and things like that. So, in other words, to get a picture of what the full impact is of shareholder, of the shareholders, you would want to look at that fully diluted. You don't have to all the time, and you'll see I don't. But really, to say, oh, to get it just the worst case scenario, if you will, I include all of those shares that could come out of the woodwork that aren't out of the woodwork right now. Yeah. That's the number of shares of a corporation that are actually out there in the marketplace. And that was actually the next thing I was going to get to here. I'm glad you're setting up the stage for it. Market? Oh, okay. Market price. That's what the current stock price is. That's just the current stock price. The market price of Microsoft right now is $28.28 a share. Is that right? Yeah. In other words, if you wanted to buy a lot, a round lot, and a round lot means 100 shares. If I wanted to buy a round lot of Microsoft, it would cost me $2,828 plus my broker fees. Okay, that's a market share. That's the market price. It's just what the current price of the stock is. So if you hear me say, what's market, or here's market in a problem, you know what I mean. Now here's an interesting one. Market cap. The cap is short for capitalization. This is the true measure of the value of a corporation. You take the market price times the number of shares outstanding. Don't do any fully diluted on this. It's just market price times the number of shares outstanding. That is the best measure of the value of a corporation. And if you ever hear an analyst say, well, this corporation is undervalued, you ask him, why? What defect in a market of hundreds of millions of traders, trillions of trades, is making it so that they can't figure out the price that is the right price for this corporation? Okay, let me give you the market cap, if I can find it, real quick. Snapshot. Well, I'm not going to do it. Here it is. The last number I'll give you is the market cap of Microsoft, MSFT, is in other words, the number of shares times the market price for share for Microsoft is $237.6 billion. That's just one corporation. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.